Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and increasingly frequently policymaking around COVID-19. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I have been hankering to talk with you about the rather chaotic two-day meeting of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the expert panel that was purged and repopulated at the behest of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. The new people on the panel were apparently so inexperienced with the evidence and procedures of the panel that even they weren't sure what they had voted on by halfway through the meeting. So I guess I'll get to the meat of it. In terms of access to vaccines for our listeners who are predominantly in California, what has changed?
Well, it depends upon what point in time we're contrasting where we are now to that point in time in terms of change. What I mean by that is not a lot has changed from what was recommended 9 months ago. What's changed is that, as you said, a very chaotic advisory committee to the CDC, a very chaotic meeting, I think chaotic's being generous, and confusing messages from that committee. Confusing is also being generous. Discrepant messages from that committee. Anyway, let me get down to it. The good news, as you alluded to, and that is if you're in California, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, you're in that Western Alliance where we have what I would consider excellent advice from our health departments. Specifically, California's health department, you can look on their website, but what they're essentially saying for COVID, as well as influenza and RSV, is not a lot of changes from previously. Let me just highlight some of these, though, that I think are really important. One is the emphasis on vaccinating children between 6 and 23 months of age. This is spelled out as a separate bullet point. This is really critical and doesn't get enough attention, and that is children in this age group, these very young children, have very significant morbidity and mortality rates comparable to older Americans. And yet the advisory committee was didn't pay any attention to that at all. That was just really horrific. Otherwise, I liked one of the bullet points that they had is all who choose protection can get the vaccine. That is, sure, if you're over 65 and at increased risk, if you're under 24 months and you're at increased risk, and sure, if you're immunocompromised or have other diseases that predispose you to a bad outcome if you get COVID, all of those folks are still in that group. But then all who choose to get protection and all who were in close contact with others with risk factors. Neither of these were addressed by the ACIP meeting. So I think what we've got here is really good recommendations, solid recommendations for the vaccine. If you're pregnant, CDPH, California Department of Public Health, came out directly and said all who are planning pregnancy, pregnant, postpartum, or lactating should get vaccinated. Because we know that if you're pregnant, your risks for COVID go up significantly. You are in a high-risk group. What the FDA, under their more recent, very poor guidance, but what the FDA directly said was that pregnant people are in that group of high-risk people. Yet the advisory committee to the CDC not only didn't address this, but through Kennedy's mouth said that it's dangerous and we're not giving pregnant people the vaccine, which is 180 degrees from the truth, because not only does it protect mom who's pregnant, but it also protects the fetus below 6 months of age. the fetus and the child born below 6 months of age, because those kids are at very increased risk, and the only protection they can get is from the immunity mom has and passes through the placenta to the fetus. Vaccines don't work. This COVID vaccine doesn't work in children less than 6 months of age. So bottom line, Brian, in the West Coast Alliance, you're in great shape. If you're in the East Coast and you've got nine states who are also in an alliance, you're in great shape. If you're in other states like Minnesota and Colorado and many others, you're in great shape because all these states have taken a proactive approach to protecting their citizens. The problem is, if you're not in one of those states, I think there are 26 states or 27 states now that have guidance to protect their citizens with vaccines. If you're not in one of those states, you still can get the vaccine. There's still a question mark whether you're going to need a note from your doctor, whether you are another healthcare professional, and they weren't specific about who that healthcare professional could be, for example, a pharmacist. So it's going to be more of a hassle for folks, but in all 50 states, you should have access to the vaccine. Cost may be an issue if the states haven't stepped in and said that they're insisting that insurance pay for it. So we're fortunate where we are.
All right. And insurance is regulated at the state level, so there's less opportunity for mayhem there. The ACIP did seem to be warming up for a big move on the childhood immunization schedule. They kind of punted on a controversial move about walking back the recommendation that pregnant people get vaccinated for hepatitis B. I guess this seemed to be, in public health circles, raising more concern than any move on COVID.
Yeah, the two major issues that the ACIP is toying with, and I think it's pretty clear they're going to be addressing in a way that's going to jeopardize Americans' health, are with the immunization schedule as a whole for children and the hepatitis B vaccine specifically for newborns. Let me address both of those briefly. The immunization schedule as a whole has been attacked by Kennedy and his ilk for a long time, saying it's too many vaccines over too short a period of time, and this is really not good for our children, and of course, causes autism. All of those are canards. None of those are true. The immunization schedule is not a schedule that people have just made up and said, gee, this looks like it would be good. It's a schedule that has been tested and tested and tested in children to optimally protect them at a time in their life when they're particularly vulnerable. So changing the immunization schedule is going to make more children more vulnerable for a longer period of time. One of the arguments about the immunization schedule that these people are using is that it's too much vaccine, too much challenge to the immune system of these young children. And you know, if you're not versed in vaccinology, which most people aren't, that seems to make sense. You picture a very young child and you picture all these shots that the child is getting and you think, oh, that's an awful lot. Well, that's a drop in the bucket in terms of the amount of challenges a child's immune system is getting on a constant basis from the trillions of organisms that live in and on that child. Also, it's a fraction of the number of challenges to the immune system a child would get if they got any one of these infectious diseases. When I say a fraction, it's a minuscule amount compared to the amount of protein that child is exposed to if the child gets disease. So this argument is bogus, but it's an argument that's been a favorite child of the anti-vax movement for a long time. But really what gets me upset is the hepatitis B issue. When children are born, they're given protection for hepatitis B with an immunization. Why? It's because hepatitis B when it infects, particularly when it infects an infant or a very young child, the child's immune system can't get rid of it. And that virus is going to be with the child the rest of the child's life. Okay, the virus is with you the rest of your life. What does that mean? What it means is a few decades later, sometimes less, the child's liver fails because of cirrhosis, or the person gets liver cancer. This is hepatitis B, along with hepatitis C, the most common causes of liver cancer worldwide. So this is a very serious problem that we can prevent by immunizing at birth. The ACIP was saying, well, we ought to immunize at 4 years of age. Well, what happens between birth and 4 years of age? If mom is infected with hepatitis B, most moms don't know it because it's silent for decades, but the baby's going to get infected through exposure to mom's blood and secretions as the child is born. And let's say the child doesn't get infected from mom at birth, but gets infected from day school or from a sibling. It's so easy for this virus to transmit. It can live outside of the human host for a while, so the child can get infected that way. Sharing a toothbrush or a scratch, it's very easy to get infected with hepatitis B. And if you wait till 4 years of age, you're going to have an awful lot of human beings infected already where the vaccine will no longer help. So I realized I said I was going to give you a short answer for this, Brian, but I went on and on. But these are two very bad ideas, changing the immunization schedule and not giving hepatitis B at birth.
Right. Hep B, they punted on even the RFK Jr. appointed people on the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices seem to be tentative about pulling the trigger on that change. So I guess we'll see what happens and what other pressures they come under before their next meeting. Dr. Swartzberg, we're going to have to break early for fundraising this morning. I wanted to run through a few questions from our inbox since it's been a couple weeks. First comes from John in San Francisco. He asked if you could comment on the efficacy of the new version of the Moderna COVID vaccine called NextSpike, which, he says, is targeted to seniors and is a lower dose.
Right. Briefly, the data that we have on NextSpike suggests that it's going to be a very good vaccine. People get a good antibody response from it with a lower dose or a lower amount of antigen that's typically given. What's really exciting about this vaccine, though, is it doesn't require the cold chain. That is, it doesn't require how cold we have to keep the vaccines before we administer them. So that really is going to make it much more advantageous in terms of distribution. So NextSpike looks like a very good vaccine from all the data we currently have.
Next question comes from Sue, no city mentioned. She writes, I live in an assisted living facility in Oakland. Okay, that's the city. It is for profit. I am worried the workers here will not be able to get the latest COVID vaccine. Are there any updates that health insurance plans will pay for the vaccine for those under 65? I think that's what you just spoke to. The answer is if they have health insurance, it'll pay for it.
Yeah, the answer is absolutely yes. If they have health insurance, they will pay for it. And hopefully if they're working in assisted living places that they will have health insurance. It's terribly important. Sue is correct. It's terribly important that people who live in assisted living are at higher risk of getting respiratory viral disease, flu, RSV, and COVID. So, and one of the ways they get infected is by people who are working there who bring the virus in. So it's terribly important that these folks are vaccinated. Unfortunately, even during the height of the pandemic, the percentage of people working in assisted living, the percentage of people getting vaccinated who were working in assisted living was much too low.
Final question comes from Sonia, no city mentioned. Can you tell us when it's the best time to get a flu shot?
Well, now is a good time. A better time is to get it 2 weeks before we start to see a lot of flu. And now we're trying to predict, like the stock market, we don't know exactly. But influenza, unlike COVID, is much more predictable. And typically, we start to see a lot of flu right around or right after Thanksgiving. So I would suggest, or what I'm planning to do, is keep a very close eye on how much influenza we're seeing in our community. Right now, we're seeing very little. And if I start to see that number going up, I'm going to get vaccinated. But if I don't see it going up, I'm going to drag my feet and do it sometime in October, and maybe even as early as the first day or two of November. The reason for that is that after you're vaccinated with the influenza vaccine, you lose protection anywhere from about 4% to 12% of protection every month. And influenza typically peaks in late January or early February, which is where you want your maximum protection, or at least a lot of protection. So trying to delay it as long as you can to keep your, but you want to keep yourself safe if influenza comes, trying to delay it is probably a good idea. So bottom line is, get it now is fine. October is an optimal month, even stretching to the end of October, the first day or two of November.
So, usual caveats on vaccine timing probably apply here, right? First is your own risk may not perfectly coincide with the population levels of influenza if you're planning on being at a multi-thousand person indoor convention in October. Maybe you want to get the shot in time to have peak antibody production before then. And the other is that if you're a busy person, and you see, they're advertising free shots when you're at the pharmacy for something else or at Kaiser for another appointment. It is so much more worthwhile to get that taken care of, even if it's a little bit early, than to park it in a part of your mental to-do list where you might not get to it in time.
Two really critical points. Thanks for mentioning those, Brian.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, we're going to leave it there for this Monday. Thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.